I think in order to leave enough time at the end for Dr. Sauer to answer questions, we should begin. We are, of course, most pleased to have Dr. Jim Sauer here this morning. Jim and I were classmates at the senior college and for a while here at the seminary, so we've known each other for a little bit of time, although not, I guess, not all that well, really. Dr. Sauer's background, since 61, he's been participating in archaeological digs and other research. He's very widely published, particularly in terms of articles on the archaeology of Jordan and on the artifacts of the work of the school, the American Center of Oriental Research there. Two announcements before we begin, or one announcement, really. Dr. Sauer will be lecturing tomorrow at Covenant Seminary at 9:50 in the morning. He will be lecturing on the archaeological explorations in the Jordan Valley, 75 and 76, and at 7:30 that evening on the geography and the archaeology of Jordan. And both of these will be in the Bushwell Library. You are cordially invited. And Dr. Mayor from Covenant is here this morning. We welcome you, as well as other guests. And rather than taking any more of your time, Jim, welcome.
Thank you, David. Very happy to be here this morning to describe for you the activities of a very delightful little center in Amman, the American Center of Oriental Research, and to put its work in the context of both biblical studies and the general history of man in that region as a whole. We're going to begin this morning by showing you something of our center, its physical plant, and then something of the history of its organization. And then we'll describe some of our activities in the city as well as archaeological projects that have been carried out since 1968 when it was founded. So if we could have the lights and the projectors on, we'll start right off here. ACOR, as we call the American Center for short, was founded in 1968 in Amman following the 1967 war, when the West Bank of Jordan was taken by Israel and the Jerusalem School of the American Schools of Oriental Research found itself within the occupied areas of Israel. The American schools were anxious to maintain archaeological work on the West Bank and East Bank both, and therefore this small center was started at that time. It's approaching its 10th anniversary about a year from now. You can see the center located in the aerial photograph to the right, positioned in the heart of the city with very developed trees around it. It happens to be, just by chance, one of the oldest facilities, one of the oldest rented buildings in that area of town. If you would happen to come to Amman and care to visit our center, which you'll see has a comfortable hostel, it's located in the Jebel Amman area of the city, which has a second circle and third circle located along the main axis of Jebel Amman. Our center is just two blocks south and one block west of this main circle, which is positioned near the Intercontinental Hotel. Once again, on the aerial photograph to the right, you can see the Intercontinental Hotel, the heart of Jebel Amman, the newer section of Amman, a very growing city in the heart of Jordan proper today, and our center is located right along this street. The center proper is pictured on the right. It's a small rented facility with the plan that you see on the left. We've rented since 1969 at this building, which consists of a first floor library, a living room, dining room and kitchen, hostel rooms for visiting scholars and students, either on a short-term visiting basis or on an annual or semi-annual basis as well. The outside garage was converted into a drafting room and storage facility for archaeological artifacts, and upstairs on the undrawn second floor is where my wife and I live in a small one-room apartment. The outside grounds of the center have been very nicely cared for in the garden, which you can see in the photograph to the right. The garden itself is a region where we spend a great deal of time in the summertime, especially for such activities as social receptions when visiting archaeologists may pass through Amman. Likewise, the backyard and the front are pleasant places to spend time in the summer. The garage, which was converted into a drafting room, now has two trained draftsmen, which are working part-time every day on the preparation of drawings for publication of some of our digs results. Our center also has a large supply of equipment to carry out major archaeological projects. These are stored at a rather run-down but still large enough facility kindly lent to us by the University of Jordan. Every dig that comes usually masses that material onto such a truck and then marches off into the hinterland to conduct some of their excavations. The interior of Acor has been greatly changed in the last several years. It's become a real public center. Prior to this, 2 years ago, it was largely just a private residence. The front porch is a comfortable place, especially in the summertime, and the living room you can see on the right. Our most important addition to the center's life took place last year when part of the archaeological library of G. Ernest Wright was added to our center, and our small but growing library is pictured in these two photographs. The dining room and kitchen, where some of you may remember Mohammed Adawi from the Jerusalem School, is now our cook, and one of the hostel rooms where visiting guests can stay. In order to make room for people, we've utilized every square inch of this tiny structure in a highly efficient operation. That means, however, that some of us have to make do with less space than we normally would, and myself included. This was formerly the hallway leading outdoors where kerosene barrels and the like were kept. That became my study to make way for one of the hostel rooms in an economy move. Upstairs, a former storage room and work facility was then converted into a very comfortable one-room apartment where my wife and I live, pictured here, our combination bedroom, dining room, and kitchen area. Now, Acor is really the inspiration of one man at this point, Dr. G. Ernest Wright, the former president of the American Schools, who was confronted by the problem of how to keep archaeological activity alive in the Arab world after the 67 war. His idea was a unique one, to create a new center in Amman for parallel work both in Jordan and in Israel. It was not sure if this would survive politically in the turmoil of the Arab Near East, but in fact it has been highly successful, and as we'll show you, other institutions of Jerusalem are now following suit, including the Germans and the British, who have also opened centers in Amman. The president of our center, appointed initially by Dr. Wright, was and still is Dr. John Marks of Princeton University. When Dr. Wright passed away, the direction of our center fell on the shoulders of his successor at Harvard, Dr. Frank Moore Cross, and the administrative director of ASOR, Dr. Newman. These two men continued to maintain interest in our center, although at this time our budget was very tiny and still is to the present day, about $24,000 to $30,000 a year total budget. These men have supported our activity in every conceivable fashion, and it's been much appreciated. 2 years was the term of Dr. Cross's presidency, and this last fall he was succeeded by Dr. Philip King, shown here in the garden of our center and visiting one of our excavation sites on the right. Dr. Edward F. Campbell, now the vice president of ASOR, in charge of excavation strategy for the entire Near East, pictured with him, visited some of our projects in the field last summer. Our center is a bit unique. For some of you who may know the Jerusalem operation, it has a distinctly different orientation. In Jerusalem, the institute there was largely independent and was responsible only to itself for its projects and activities. In Amman, we are closely tied to other institutions in what is a greater obligation to those institutions and is a greater opportunity also for us to contribute to the growth of the country. In particular, we have a close relationship with the Department of Antiquities in Amman, which is the oldest archaeological institution in the country dating back to 1918. They are growing at the moment and therefore are constructing a new facility only about two blocks away from Acor. With two fine archaeologists, the best archaeological library, drafting facilities, and other specialized rooms planned in this new building that should be completed later this summer. We've also, from the beginning, in 1968, had a very close relationship with the University of Jordan. Founded in 1962, pictured on the left is its large campus today. It's a growing and very active university, up to about 5,000 students. From the beginning, this university had an archaeological faculty, one professor and a few students. That has now grown up to 5 faculty members and about 25 students, some in the BA program, undergraduate, but even a larger number in the master's program, which was started about 4 years ago. The archaeological faculty is contained in the building you see on the right, which also houses the brand new archaeological museum, which is found underneath it. Our center from the beginning has had a joint relationship with this university in that the director of the center always teaches courses at the university and is considered a visiting professor in the Faculty of Archaeology there. Therefore, our professors have taught sometimes up to 3 courses, a full load each semester. Now it's down to 1 course, but the highly specialized courses in the master's program and the BA program has been taken over entirely by the new young returning Jordanian archaeologists who have just gotten their PhDs at Chicago, Princeton, Yale, and other fine Western universities. In addition to these institutions, we have an informal but not joint relationship with the other new centers in Amman, especially the British School of Archaeology, headed by Crystal Bennett, founded just 2 years ago in Amman in a rented facility opposite the university. On the right is the new German Institute of Archaeology. The Germans are just building their facility, but they are very fortunate in having Volkswagen money, which allows them to both own their property and their building. And this is just the beginning of what is to become a much larger major archaeological complex. Ute Lux, the director of the German school in Jerusalem, will also direct this center, which sponsors projects like the British school throughout the country. There are some popular organizations in Amman. There's a great deal of interest in archaeology in that country, and we have a responsibility as a center to also be involved with the local scene in that respect. One organization called the Friends of Archaeology dates back to the 1960s and is a multinational group of laymen who go out and visit sites, who sponsor lectures on archaeology by visiting and qualified local archaeologists every month of the year. This group is pictured on the left making one of its trips down into the Jordan Valley at the site of Gosul. Numbering about 250, they consist of Americans, Europeans, many Jordanians, and it's a very active and thriving group. In addition to that group, when I became director, I also initiated for the first time the practice at ACOR of having courses for the public taught at ACOR on a regular basis. And I taught 2 courses in 1974 to 1976, year-long courses, 9-month courses. You might not believe it, but actually about 30 people turned out twice a week for 2 hours just to hear about the pottery of Jordan for 9 months. And then the next year, about the same amount came for a more general course called the History of the History of the Archaeology of Jordan. A group on the right, you see, of some of those students that we had at the center visiting one of the more important early bronze sites in the Jordan Valley from about 3000 BC when we made one of our normal field trips out into the countryside. My wife and I are quite active also in making a number of trips into the various regions of Jordan. This is a trip which we made with the American ambassador, whose support we enjoy very much in the country, out into the desert regions where numerous prehistoric sites can be found. And one of the more esoteric types of trips that I've taken in the last few years around Jordan was a project to aerial photograph more than 150 of the major well-known archaeological sites. I'm picture here of my very fine British pilot and Jordanian military attaché who made sure I didn't photograph any sensitive areas. So, actually our center is a delightful place to be. We enjoy full support of all people in the country, and although we have a tiny budget, our center has been remarkably active in the 9 years of its existence in an effort to reconstruct the total archaeological history of the East Bank of Jordan. Let me introduce you now to the geography of the country briefly, and then on the right to some of the projects that we'll be describing in the rest of this lecture. Jordan is a small country located to the east of a great rift valley, which consists of the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River Valley, the Dead Sea, the Wadi Araba, and the Red Sea, all below sea level down to about 1,300 feet. Just to the east of that is a high ridge rising to about 3,000 to 5,000 feet above sea level, which receives enough rainfall today to support about 2 million, a population of about 2 million. 95% of Jordan off to the east of this green strip of land is desert area. Not a desert like many of us might imagine, a sandy, duny area, but rather a sloping plateau region that runs off towards the east, where in this point you have a number of dry lake beds and river beds that streak off towards this region called the Wadi Sirhan. This 95% desert region is today largely unoccupied, but that was not always the case. In the prehistoric periods, we have many remains of primitive man out in this desert region, located next to these lakes and rivers, and prehistory in Jordan is becoming a very cutting edge of future research. The only active lake that we have in the area is the Azraq Oasis, where there is still enough water. Northeast Jordan and southeast Jordan have volcanic outflows, which effectively seal off this part of the country from movement, and combined with the Rift Valley on the west, it makes Jordan a bit of a unit, which could be approached only from the north, from the east, and from the south through some very fairly well-defined passes. Of course, modern-day Israel and parts of Jordan are located to the west of this line, and in Old Testament history, this is the primary region of the Holy Land, the Old Testament Israelite period, although the Israelites were also often located in North Jordan. Jordan in the biblical periods is most famous for being the land of Israel's neighbors, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites. And then in New Testament times, Christ's ministry takes place here and in North Jordan, while at that time a quite different occupation called the Nabataeans, Nabataean period, was in the southernmost part of the country. Biblical history lies thus at the center and core of Jordan as a geographical region, but it is only one small segment of that history. Jordan's history stretches well back into the prehistoric periods and extends down to the modern day, and it has been possible to synthesize the entire history of that country, as will be done in one of my lectures tomorrow night. Today we want, however, to sample what ACOR as a center has done to contribute to that general synthesis in the way of small projects, major projects, and surveys since 1968. On the right, you can see now the map of Jordan showing the position of our major activities. Conspicuously blank is the southernmost part of Jordan, which is an area that our center has done very little in, and that is true for most of the centers, except for the British. The lowest part of Jordan is the region where we know the least, the land of Moab and Edom, and where our highest priorities exist for future work in those parts of the country. A concentration of effort, you can see, exists around the area of Amman itself, the capital of the country. That's natural because this is the area most easily reached, and salvage projects as well as major excavations can be carried out quite easily there. We also have had a few projects in the northern part of Jordan. And then we'll be mentioning as well work in the center next to the Dead Sea at Bab Edra, an early bronze site overlooking the shore of the Dead Sea. Our survey projects, which are not excavation projects, but rather efforts to cover the surface of the ground in detail, to locate new sites, to date them by pottery and the like, included work in the Jordan Valley Survey, which we'll be describing, which covered the entire east half of the Jordan Valley, a Roman fort survey, which covered all of the Roman forts built about the 3rd century AD along the edge of the desert, and a Safaidic survey in the north part of the desert proper. Let's begin with one of our major projects located not far from Amman, Hesban, or Heshbon. Many people in the room may be well familiar with this site. Dr. Mayer and others have been active participants as staff members on this excavation. Begun in 1968 by Siegfried Horn, he selected the site because of its name, Hesban, which clearly preserved the Arabic version of ancient Heshbon of the Old Testament, most famous for being the capital of Sihon, which was destroyed, according to biblical tradition, by the Israelites, and then reoccupied by the Israelites until late in the Iron Age when the Ammonites pushed them out. The excavations here in the first three seasons for Dr. Horn were rather disappointing because in the uppermost parts of the site where work was originally concentrated, nothing prior to the Roman period was found down to bedrock in each area. However, as you can see on the right, when excavation was extended to the lower slopes of the site, there were earlier remains at the site of the Iron Age, but not of the preceding Late Bronze Age, as we'll describe in a moment. This is Dr. Horn, the initiator and project overseer of the project. And on the right is Dr. Lawrence T. Geraghty of Andrews University, which was the sponsoring institution. Dr. Geraghty succeeded his professor, Horn, as the director of the project in 1974 and 1976. Here, Dr. Geraghty is showing His Majesty King Hussein around the site at the end of the last campaign. Since this project is now concluded, we're very fortunate in Jordan to enjoy the active support of all levels of government right up to the highest. Interest in our work is high, not just for its intrinsic sake, but because Jordan is convinced that by studying its very long past, it can learn a great deal about its present and future development, and we'll give you an example of that later in the lecture. Heshban, in its excavations, turned out to be first occupied at 1200 BC, the beginning of the Iron I period. We went down to bedrock on all areas of the site, and there was never anything preceding that. Not one sherd of Late Bronze was ever found at the site. However, Iron I was attested only on the lower slopes, not on the uppermost part of the tell, where it was clear that the Romans had scraped off the top of the site, dumping the earlier remains onto the slope proper. Only in cracks in bedrock, where the Romans would not quite have scraped, would you find then the earliest occupation of the 12th century BC. That occupation is pictured for you here on the left. Very impressive, I'm sure, is this tiny crack in bedrock, which we would otherwise pay hardly any attention to if it weren't for the fact that it gave us this very primitive pottery which you see on the right. This type of pottery, coming from this 12-foot long, several feet wide, and 6-foot deep crack in bedrock, is a distinctive type called Iron 1A, attested at many sites on the West Bank, and long ago identified by Albright as early Israelite, representing the period of the Judges. That pottery, coming from here, I do believe, does represent the earliest Israelite occupation at the site. What, however, do we do then with the problem of the conquest? Ideally, Horn would have wanted to find a Late Bronze city with a conquest on top, followed then by this material, but there is nothing earlier. Of course, we could follow someone like Joe Calloway, who has the same problem at Ai on the West Bank, and who would divide this pottery in half and say that half is Canaanite and that half is Israelite. I think you'll see, however, it's rather difficult to shove Sihon down at the bottom of this trench and to argue that the Israelites lived right on top of him. And this is, I think, a bit of a bad effort to try to force the archaeological evidence into some pattern of agreement with biblical evidence. There is another possibility, and that is an old Albrightian trick to argue that the site moved, as he did at Ai and Bethel. And we have a major site not far from Heshban called Tel Jalul, which is 5 miles away and does attest extensive Late Bronze pottery as well as the Iron Age. It's entirely possible, it's within the realm of possibility, that that site does represent Canaanite Heshban and that the name moved to this site. And in fact, the whole region of Heshban is called Heshban and not only the Tel. A third possibility, which as scientific scholars we cannot eliminate, is one which I do not prefer to opt for, but is still a possibility, and that is the possibility that, of course, the biblical tradition is much later and is not reflected at all in the archaeological evidence, thus not being an historical account. Whatever the solution, which we can't at this point solve, I do believe this represents Israelite occupation. And perhaps work at Jalul, as we hope will begin 3 or 4 years from now, may shed light on the problem. Heshban was reoccupied in the Iron II period, about the 7th century by the Ammonites, when they had settled in Ammon and moved into this area, pushing the Israelites out. From that period, we have one of the finest installations ever to be found in Ammonite terrain, about a 40-foot square reservoir for water, which was is drawn for you on the right, with a corner here and a corner at the other side. It would have originally been square or rectangular, 20 feet deep with a 1-foot plaster layer at the bottom. It was constructed of beautiful header stretcher stones and vertically cut bedrock with channels of water to lead the water from the top of the site into it. On the left, you can see the header stretcher wall, the vertical bedrock. This is one of our unexcavated blocks on the left, and here are the channels for water. This particular type of architecture is distinctively Iron II, 9th to 7th century, and is best paralleled by material from Samaria, the capital of the Israelites at this time, contemporary with their Ammonites across the river. We get an interesting lesson in the history of religions from the site when we turn to the Roman period. The Romans scraped off the top of the site and constructed there a great temple which crowned the place where the previous Iron Age occupations had been. In the process, they and their predecessors in the Hellenistic period dumped all of the preceding material down into that old abandoned reservoir in an effort to renovate the entire site. Here you can see the corner of the reservoir. Over the top of it are these white layers which have been excavated here and left just in section. Those white layers led to this fine stairway which led up from the base of the site towards the Acropolis proper. It wasn't a big surprise to find these stairs because they were dated by pottery and coins to the 3rd century AD, exactly the time when we knew there should be a temple at the site. How did we know? Because a coin of Esbus, as the site later was called, shows on it a fine Roman temple with four columns and a stairway leading up to it. This Roman pagan temple was positioned on the top of the Acropolis, and then it was replaced 200 years later in the 5th century AD by a Christian church, and Christianity replaced Roman paganism as the religion of the site. Down below here, out of view, is the foundation material of the old temple. Now you can see in the background, however, what has been built over it and reused materials from it, the Christian church. This is the apse of the church on the east and the column bases which were in the aisles. The column bases, however, are not Byzantine 5th century Christian types. They are 3rd century Roman pagan types and are clearly reused from the old temple, yanked out of position and used again. Also, the apse contains not new stone materials, but some of the column capitals are tipped on their sides to create the apse in a clear reuse of former Roman materials. There was a real battle of religion between Roman paganism and Christianity about 400 AD, which resulted in the victory of Christianity, and that is reflected in this sequence from temple to church. Then, however, the church went out of existence 250 years later, about 630 to 640 AD. This is the fine mosaic floor, which was originally in the apse of the building, and you can see that it's very ragged along its edges. It was originally a perfect mosaic floor, but in the early Islamic period, when the Arabs of Arabia converted to Islam, they came up, captured this site, and the church went out of existence. We find pits and installations of industrial types cutting down into the floor of the church, showing that this church, like many others throughout Jordan, then passed on into an Islamic non-religious occupation of the formerly Christian area. The site of Hesban was finally occupied in the medieval Islamic period from 1200 to 1400 AD, when it was an ancient holiday inn. It was converted into a caravanserai located along the main trade route, and at that time it had a beautifully preserved bath in one segment of the courtyard. This bath was entered here, and you would pass under the door here into the privacy of the chamber proper. It was so well designed that hot water would come from a basin heated by a furnace at this point, and cold water from a neighboring basin that was not heated. The structure was so well designed that the furnace under the hot basin didn't only heat the water, but also heated hot air that was then piped through small pipes under the floor where you were standing to keep your feet warm while you took your bath. So Hesban was one of our major projects starting in 1968, and we've just summarized some of the results of that project up till its last season last summer, 1976. The project is finished, and we now return to the chronological history of some of the other projects in the country. In 1969, Dr. Rudolf Dornemann was our first annual professor in Amman, and while he was in Amman, he conducted a major, small project at the capital of the Ammonites, Amman. This is the modern capital of Jordan, and nestled in its center is the ancient capital of the Ammonites, Rabat Ammon, in an L-shaped tell. Dr. Dornemann worked at this corner of the site, which you can also see in the ground photograph to the right. His results were very important for Near Eastern archaeology because he found our first Middle Bronze glacis type fortification, which is a distinctive type about 1600 BC. This fortification wall running along here was of Middle Bronze date in his excavations, and in the close-up photograph on the right, which is about 2 feet across in the photograph, you see a white plaster layer which is sloping up but then cut off at this point. This sloping white plaster layer is a distinctive glossy or sloping skirt running around the base of the site, which is the first Middle Bronze evidence that was discovered at Amman, aside from a tomb on one of the neighboring slopes. Dr. Roger Boras became the director of the center briefly in the summer of 1969, and at that time conducted a small project at one of the Iron Age towers in the city. This tower, Rujam al-Malfouf, or the Round Tower, is pictured in aerial photograph on the left and from the ground on the right. This tower, Rujam al-Malfouf, or the Round Tower, is pictured in aerial photograph on the left and from the ground on the right. You'll remember that Nelson Glick, in his surveys of eastern Palestine, had argued that the Ammonites had a series of 30 or 40 round and square towers surrounding their ancient capital city, and that this was an Ammonite defense system. When Roger excavated inside this tower in 1969 in a small sounding of several squares, he found only Roman pottery of the 3rd century AD from top to bottom, and argued in a couple of articles, which were then quoted extensively elsewhere, that Glick was probably wrong and the entire Ammonite defense system is really Roman and not of the biblical period at all. That work, here is Dr. Boras on the right, on the left, one of our finest stratigraphers, and the interior of the structure as it was excavated in later years. Dr. Boras continued to work at the site in 1974 with the Department of Antiquities also involved, and as we will see, his position needed to be modified because from the lowest portion of the unexcavated part, which was then subsequently excavated by the Department of Antiquities, Iron Age pottery did appear at the lowermost part of the interior of the tower, showing that it was Ammonite after all. We had known that as a likelihood anyway because of the architecture, but the divider walls on the interior are clearly Roman rebuilds of the original Ammonite shell. So Glick was right after all. It is an Ammonite defense tower, but he was also wrong, because when he considered it to be Ammonite, he considered it to be 12th to 7th centuries B.C. Now we know that they are of the late Ammonite period, the 7th century and 6th centuries B.C. Dr. Bastian Van Eldren, was the director of our center for several years in 1972 and 73, and his specialization while director was in Byzantine churches. He became known as sort of the mosaic man of Jordan and went around excavating a number of salvage projects whenever people would dig down the foundations of their houses and expose Christian Byzantine mosaics of church floors. On the right is the beginning of such a mosaic floor where the workman has just begun to unfold the typical scene in Jordan, a fine mosaic pavement. That happens to be occurring at this site, Madaba, most famous as a mosaic capital of Jordan, viewed from the air and from the ground. The work at this site has produced many Christian churches, of the several of the more than 300, which are known to have been in Jordan during the high point of Christian occupation. On the left is a typical plan of such a church in Madaba with the apse to the east. And on the right, one of the more typical mosaic pavements, non-religious, that is, Christian in character and with a Christian Greek inscription at the front, but with non-religious symbolism in the floor itself, just geometric designs and animals of everyday life. Bastian Van Eldren was overlapped and partly replaced by Dr. Henry Thompson, whose picture I can't show you because I don't have one, but Dr. Thompson was in Amman for 2 years as director and then annual professor of our center until 1973 as well. His most important project in the country was at Tel Siran, pictured on the left in aerial photograph and on the right from the ground. This site is located right on the campus of the Jordan University, and as part of his training project, he took his students out here to give them practical experience in field work. Quite accidentally, coming from Siran, was this fine bottle. I say accidentally because I don't really even believe it's an ancient tell. This was terraced in the last 50 years, and I think it's quite possible that this significant find was brought in by a dump truck only 15 or 20 years ago when they brought in the soil from elsewhere. However it may be, this object, which came from a late context, Turkish and modern pottery being present, is our best Ammonite inscription ever to be discovered in the country. It's called the Tel Siran bronze bottle. It's about the size of your thumb. It was originally thought to be just an ordinary little bottle until it was cleaned up, and then the fine characters incised in it in pure Ammonite were found. It mentions the king Amminadab, known already from Old Testament sources, gives several of his ancestors, his public works, and then wishes for himself a happy life at the end in a probable poetic structure. Dr. Thompson also worked during his tenure at the center at a site called Tel Siran. What's the name of this site? I'm sorry. Nameless Tell here. All right, it'll come to me. It'll come to me in just a minute. It's a very important site, viewed from the air right here. It's small tell, which was very appealing for in the terms of a small project. And Dr. Thompson, in his work there, discovered a number of occupations going back to Iron One, the same representative selection as we have at Heshbon, but it was most important for giving us additional material of the Ammonite period. Found at the site were these fine statues, 2.5 feet tall, of which this is one example. This is an Ammonite king with his distinctive crown on the head, and this is the first coin ever to be found in Jordan, the earliest coin of about the 7th and 6th centuries BC, with the Athenian owl on it, evidence of our first use of money in the country. The statue of the king was accompanied by several female statues as well. Kirbat el-Hajar is the name of the site. The ruin of stones, and this type of crown we have found on numerous Ammonite statues, all of them being kings. It reminds us that when David defeated the Ammonites, he took as one item of booty one Ammonite crown, very likely one looking like this, since it's a standardized variation on the Egyptian design. Dr. Thompson also worked at a small tower like this one, viewed, as you can see, right up next to some modern houses. Like the round tower excavated by Dr. Boras, it turned out to be a 7th century BC Ammonite type defending the city proper. In 1973 and 74, I moved to Amman, first as annual professor and then subsequently as director, where I have been since that time. Pictured here with Dr. Van Eldren and a number of people from the Heshbon excavation, and my wife Sue, who's also here today, pictured on the right. One of my major projects was also in 1974 and 76 to check at that time about the date of the Ammonite towers which surrounded the city of Amman. This is Hilda, one of those towers which I excavated the interior and exterior of. The walls, you can see, were constructed of massive architecture. The interior gave us the same as Dr. Boras's, only Roman pottery, while the exterior gave us only Iron Age of the 7th century, showing that the Romans had dumped the materials outside the walls, cleaning it down to bedrock, and reusing the interior entirely. Nearby, we also found our only Iron Age road yet found in Jordan of about the 7th century BC, explaining why this tower was positioned where it was. This road ran almost to Amman and off in the direction of the Jordan Valley. In 1974, Dr. Bert de Vries, one of our architects from the center, was greatly intrigued by the greatest of all Byzantine sites in Jordan, el-Jamal. It's about 1/2 mile in length and a quarter mile in width. Located in the desert, it looks, as you come upon it, like a city which was just destroyed by atomic bomb. Dating from the 6th century primarily, it has more than 13 Christian churches in it, and Dr. De Vries was very anxious to plan it, but with aerial photographs and with ground survey plans, and that work was carried out in 1974, and he'll be returning this summer to continue for 6 months. This is an example of some of the finest architecture there. The black color, which makes it look like a city recently destroyed, is the result of the basalt and lava stone, which was used as the sole building material at the site. This building material also explains why it is so well preserved, sometimes 2 and 3 floors high, because it could be cut into long beams, almost like wood, which would then stick out and roof over the area and preserve it up to rooftop. Dr. De Vries was not only anxious to plan this very important Byzantine site, but to know its history. Therefore, in 1974, he and I and a team of volunteers went up for 1 week and excavated into the old rubbish dumps of the site where people threw out their garbage in ancient times. From the bottom of these probes, we would try to collect from each layer pottery and from the bottom came the earliest material, early Roman, of about 63 B.C., showing that the site grew at the time when the Roman occupation began in Jordan. Then it survived and prospered through the Roman and Byzantine periods until at the uppermost level we found the latest period being of the Islamic date, about 700 A.D. It was then destroyed about 750 A.D. and never again reoccupied throughout its entire history, the result of a squabble between two rival Arab tribes, the Abbasids of Iraq and the Umayyads of Damascus, and the Umayyads of Damascus lost in 750 A.D. This site, as well as Jerash and many other great former Byzantine cities, were then destroyed and never again reoccupied down to the modern day. One of our most significant projects in the last several years, 1975 and 76, has been a joint survey in the Jordan Valley, sponsored by our center and by the Department of Antiquities and University of Jordan. This is Dr. Kher Yassin, myself, Dr. Ibrahim, and my wife, Sue, shown down at our base camp in the valley where we worked for 7 weeks in the winters of 75 and 76, almost exactly a year ago. We covered the entire valley floor with Land Rovers on foot, and with every possible systematic effort in a program to discover all of the archaeological sites between the Jordan River and the foothills and everything from the Yarmouk River in the north down to the Dead Sea at the south. We collected pottery, made descriptions, photographed, and described all of the sites, and we discovered 226 sites in a region which Glick, the previous explorer, had only found about 90 to 100. Thus, we doubled and in almost one case tripled the number of sites, and there's nothing quite so thrilling as, in fact, to discover new sites on such a project. We'd like to give you just some of the results of our project, which produced results ranging in date from 10,000 B.C., the Mesolithic period, down to 1918, the Turkish period. We can begin here with the Neolithic period, late Neolithic, with one new site that was discovered at this time, from the time when pottery was first invented, about 6,000 B.C. This is the Zirka River, the biblical Jabbok, flowing through the heart of the valley floor proper, and located along the edge of that river was an ancient site which we found by combing, as we did every river site, immediately alongside it. Primitive handmade pottery, some of which is on the table in the back, came from the site, as well as this earliest pet rock in history, the small pebble figurine, which is about the size of your fingernail, picked up by one of our volunteers. It has a use patina on it and has been clearly carved of a type which has frequently been found in Israel called the Shahar HaGolan type of late Neolithic figurine. Early Bronze, the period of major city-states, was also well represented in our survey. This is Tel Abu Kharaz, identified by Glick perhaps as Jabesh Gilead, since the Wadi Yabes runs right next to it. It was first built in the early Bronze period, and the fortification line, which you can see beneath the vegetation in the aerial photograph, conceals the former fortifications probably of the early Bronze Age. The pottery which you see on the right is distinctively early Bronze I, about 3,100 B.C., of the northern variety, which is beautifully painted in a grain wash technique. The late Bronze Age, the Canaanite period, was also well represented, about 1500 to 1200 B.C. On the left, you see one of our fine stratigraphic probes into a significant late bronze tomb. You should be laughing because we don't really dig like that. This is the way the site looked as we came upon it in the midst of a tomb robbing operation. And the subject of the operation was a fine late bronze tomb. We continued to rob what they had been robbing, and got not only this fine pottery, but some typical late bronze cosmopolitan artifacts, such as you see on the right. This is a vase imported from Egypt. These are some of the finest bronze weapons yet discovered in Jordan, and a beautiful bull figurine. When we come to the Iron Age, we had an unusual opportunity in the valley, because G. Ernest Wright had long ago argued that the Philistines had penetrated from the seacoast of Israel by way of the plain of Esdraelon down into the central Jordan Valley, and that then the Israelites dominated the south part of the valley in an effort to connect West Israel and East Israel in the Israelite period. Since we were treading all of this region, we had an opportunity to see the ceramic distribution from north to south, and in fact Wright was supported in every respect. In the north part of the valley, such as at Tel Derala, we found only pottery of this variety, the early Philistine type material with its distinctive but rather primitive birds in this area. In the south part of the valley, however, we got early Israelite type material, which is far cruder of the type I showed you already from Hesban. This is from a very significant site located immediately opposite Jericho, newly discovered on our survey. It's a possible candidate for Shittim. If it was on the west side, it'd be a good possibility for Gilgal. It's a one-period site only of the early Israelite material, and is a clear bridge between the two regions of the valley. On the right is not that site, since it's a low site, not rising up above the hills. This is one of our more distinctive mud brick sites, which rises up very high off the plain of the valley from the late Bronze Age to the end of the Iron II period, when it went out of existence at the end of the Old Testament period. In the valley, the Roman period is well represented also. We find such milestones as these, which were located next to the old Roman road system. And we jump, finally, to conclude with the Mamluk period, the medieval period from 1200 to 1400 AD, when the valley prospered as a center of sugar production. We found numerous of these great sugar mills, 15 to 20 feet in diameter, resting on vaulted arches, which were water-powered along all of the small rivers that run into the valley floor. Called Tal Asukkar, Kirbit Asukkar, each of them preserving the name sugar. When we turn to the Arab sources, we found that, in fact, the Jordan Valley was the center of sugar production in the Mamluk period for much of the Near East. We find typical Mamluk pottery with its handmade painted designs, once dated by Selene to the 5th century BC, but now known to be of the latest period, although it is very primitive in its technique, alongside the very fine glazed wares which were imported during the period from Syria. These sugar mills, as well as the entire Mamluk occupation, went out of existence in 1400 AD during a tremendous invasion by Tamerlane, which devastated the entire region and left Jordan nomadic for the next 600 years. George Mendenhall of University of Michigan was the director of the center for 6 months in 1975, and he had always had a pet project in Jordan, namely Rajum, another of those Iron Age towers. Nearby that tower was a cistern which contained a number of very unusual drawings inside, and he had the idea that these drawings were Iron Age in date. I don't have a photograph of the drawings since they are inside this great cistern, but we excavated together there in 75 to check whether the drawings could really be that early. In fact, although he left the site convinced they were, I left the site convinced they weren't, because we got Roman pottery also in this cistern up to the level where the drawings begin, which he would prefer to disregard. On the left, you can see some of our sounding operations against the tower proper, which is clearly and definitely of the Iron II 7th century date. One of our other major projects, Bab Edra, was first started by Paul W. Lapp, and his project included excavations at this site in the 1960s in the fortified areas of the settlement overlooking the Dead Sea, as well as in the cemetery region nearby. On the lower right, you can see the drawing of this typical early bronze fortified city from 3200 to 2100 BC. This is the old riverbed that supported the occupation area. The cemetery site had been claimed to be the largest of the early bronze cemeteries anywhere in the Near East, and perhaps a central cemetery for the whole region. In 1973, Thomas Schaub and Walter Rast, two of his students, succeeded Lapp in his work here after his untimely death, and they concentrated on the theory of the cemetery. They discovered an additional four more sites along the shore of the Dead Sea, spaced about 5 miles apart, each of the early Bronze Age period. Each of them also had cemeteries, and therefore they have modified the position that this cemetery is unique. Rather, it is a localized cemetery for the city proper. They've suggested quietly and never in print, but it should still be noted that there may be some connection between these five cities and the cities of the plain of Old Testament times. You will well remember that biblical archaeologists such as Albright and Wright always like to put these cities under the shore of the Dead Sea. There are dating problems and other problems, obviously, but it is still something which is in the realm of possibility. Typical for the early bronze occupation at the site is this little belly dancer on the left, and the type of pottery, early bronze 1A, the earliest early bronze pottery ever found in Jordan. This pottery provoked a tremendous conflict between Wright and Lapp in the 1960s. It turns out that while Lapp was incorrect in the size of the cemetery, he was certainly correct in the date, and it is from 3200 BC. One of our projects in 1976, a small project, was carried out by a young nut from Australia who was intrigued by a discipline in which very few people are involved, Safavidic inscriptions. Safavidic inscriptions are a type of pre-Islamic Arabic dating from the 3rd century A.D., written by nomadic Bedouin who lived in the desert region of Jordan, especially in the north part in that basalt and lava area that I described in the first photograph of geography. On the left, you can see what that northeast part of Jordan looks like, where the lava has broken down into great head and body sized blocks of basalt. You can imagine that if you lived out here, as those nomads did, you wouldn't have had much to do. And they didn't. On the right, you can see what they did with their time. They piled up these boulders into great piles, and then they doodled. They carved their favorite camel, as well as a few camel drivers and other hunt scenes, and then they always signed their masterpieces in typical Safavidic Arabic. These Kilroy were here type inscriptions have been studied by very few people, but Vincent went out last year and collected drawings and photographs of about 1,000 of them. He's taken them off to Australia, where he thinks he'll be able to convince a committee they'll be worth a PhD. Actually, it's a very important project, but it's easy to poke fun at these kinds of inscriptions. The enemies of these nomads in the desert were the Romans, who had to protect the settled regions against those nomads, and that was the subject of a project by Thomas Parker of UCLA last summer, 1976. He went out and collected pottery from the more than 60 Roman forts and camps, which were positioned along Jordan, such as you see on the right. By collecting the pottery from each one, he could date the history of each fort, and then by comparing the whole string of forts, he could reconstruct the history of the whole line. And he determined that it was built in the early Roman period, and that it was especially augmented during the 3rd century AD, the time of Diocletian, and that it went out of existence at the end of the Byzantine period when this region collapsed in the face of Islam. This is an aerial photograph of one of the better preserved forts, and on the right, one of the fine camps, the size of about 6 to 7 football fields of that Roman defense line. Paul App had also been intrigued by Arak el-Emir in Jordan, and it was one of his first excavations. We picture it on the left in photograph and on the right in plan. It's located near Amman, and he was attracted to it because Josephus, the Jewish historian of AD 70, had described it as having a moat with a palace with lions on it and nearby caves where the parties went on so late at night that they could be heard halfway across the valley. Lapp came out here to dig in 1961 and 62. He excavated at the palace but failed to get the evidence of its original occupation. Here is the moat, the palace, the moat area inside the dam, and the cave area of Josephus is in the background. Here is the dam, the moat, and the palace. Last spring, two French archaeologists working out of our center for the Department of Antiquities tackled the project once again, and they have uncovered some beautiful new examples of architecture, especially the best preserved fragment of lion torso that collapsed from the second story of that fine palace. Also, last summer, we had a small project at the Amman Airport Temple, carried out by a young graduate student from Harvard University. This temple was the subject of great debate. It's a late bronze temple from 1400 BC, and it was often thought to be a unique one. We now have others, but in fact, this one, produced in its 1950s excavation, burned human bones on the inside, evidence either of child sacrifice or cremation before burial. It was objected that no one had ever tested whether there was occupation around this or not, and so a project was carried out in October. In fact, it failed to turn up more occupation around the site, but in fact, it wasn't even necessary to prove that because we have major city-state sites not far away, evidence that this could not have been a nomadic shrine as had sometimes been postulated. In October, I'll conclude with this small project. In October, that is of our projects, our present projects, we got a phone call from one of the higher princes in the Jordanian government who was building a swimming pool in his backyard and had interrupted some architecture in the bedrock. And coming out, Bernd Getting, a young German architect, and I managed to plan what developed into the finest preserved Roman wine press that we've ever found, somewhat to the embarrassment of the teetotaling emir. This fine press, as you can see here, had a circular press area where the grapes would have been put, a settling basin here, and then a large grape-catching area down below. The photograph on the right gives you a better example. There are such examples known from other sites, but never dated. Fortunately, the workmen who cleaned this out before we arrived had saved the pottery from down in this area, and it was pure 3rd century A.D. Roman material and nothing earlier or later. That's where we are to date. I would just like to briefly mention where we would like to go slightly into the future and show you a couple of major projects and minor ones that we see as high priorities for our center. This is Tell Jalul, which I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture, is 5 miles from Hespan, which has a full sequence of early bronze, middle bronze, late bronze, and Iron Age. We would hope that within 3 years, a major project could be carried out at this largest of all sites in central Jordan to give us a full sequence of ceramic work there. An alternative to that, or a second site in north Jordan, would be Tell el-Hussein, viewed from the air and from the ground. It is my candidate, actually, for Ramoth-Gilead. It's the largest Iron Age site in North Jordan and has, again, a full range from early bronze through Iron Age. A project that we hope will be underway in June is a second of those late bronze-type temples, which we described at the Amman Airport. This one was discovered during the last 2 years, and Robin Brown and Pat McGovern, two students at our center, will be digging here in June. Very important nearby is a cave which produced large quantities of late bronze pottery in an area where Glick had found none, and it could conceivably develop into a very significant but small project. Our other main efforts are to concentrate in surveys. We mentioned Edom and Moab, but we cannot close without also mentioning the East Jordanian Desert, where prehistoric remains abound. These prehistoric remains are located next to those extinct rivers and lakes all over the desert, which dried up and forced man off there about 6,000 BC. You can walk out over the desert floor proper alongside those rivers and lake beds and uncover such spectacular sites as this one, 1 acre in size. I've intentionally taken the photograph directly into the sun so that the sun reflects off of every man-made flint artifact which covers the surface of the ground. No pottery. This is a pre-pottery site, usually dated about 35,000 BC. On the right, you can see a close-up of 1 square foot of the chocolate-colored type flints which have turned dark with age from being exposed on the desert floor. Originally, this site would have been 2 or 3 feet thick, but the soil material which contained the artifacts has eroded away by wind, leaving this great concentration of flints that you see on the valley floor proper. Here you can see some of the most distinctive types of flints, and on the right, reproduced the beautiful blades, which are characteristic, as well as circular scrapers and more advanced core scrapers. We have one prehistorian from the University of Tulsa who hopes to come out and do a real thorough study of the Jordanian desert, and this promises to be one of our real important new phases in the history of ACOR. I hope that gives you a good idea of what we've done, what we're about to do, and what, as an institute, we think we're all about. Thank you very much.